Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, my name is Tim Wyatt and you're listening to Matters of Life and Death. This week we're digging into assisted dying. A bill to legalise it in England has been introduced to Parliament. What does it propose? And how likely is it to actually become law? And zooming out a little, what are the social factors behind this renewed push to introduce a form of euthanasia to Britain for the first time? And in particular, via the House of Lords of all places. And finally, we discuss what we might be able to learn from Canada, which has brought in its own form of assisted suicide with some alarming consequences since we in the UK last debated this issue 6 years ago. Stay with us as I speak with my dad, the doctor and professor of ethics, John Wyatt, to chat about all that and much more. Welcome, John. Thanks for dialing in again for another episode of Matters of Life and Death. Our topic today is going to be assisted dying. Some people will have seen this is kind of rising in the news agenda. There's a new bill being introduced into the House of Lords we're about to discuss. But first off, what do we mean by assisted dying? Is it the same as euthanasia? Is it different to assisted suicide? Some people might be a bit confused around the language here.
Well, it's very important just before we get going to define terms. And this strange phrase, assisted dying, is a deliberately euphemistic phrase which has been adopted by the pro-assisted suicide and euthanasia lobby groups. And it's undoubtedly what it means is a physician providing lethal drugs to a person with a terminal illness and with the intention that that person should kill themselves. And so in any other setting, this would be described as suicide or taking one's own life. But the lobby groups have chosen this phrase, assisted dying, and it seems pretty obvious that that's because it sounds nice and euphemistic. And there's quite a lot of evidence, you know, that when public polls are done, so if you stop people in the street and say, do you think the law should be changed to allow doctors to assist dying people so they die peacefully and quietly and without pain, not surprisingly, a large majority of the British population say, yes, the law should be changed to allow that. But if you spell out precisely what's meant, then the percentages change significantly.
And it's also, I think, a way of steering away from kind of, or at least obfuscating the legal position. So as people might know, might not know, suicide itself is not a criminal act, though it was historically until 1960s in this country. It was decriminalized. So it's no longer a crime to kill yourself or to attempt to kill yourself. But it is still a crime, a criminal offense, punishable by, I believe, up to 8 years in prison to help another person kill themselves. And so I think part of the emphasis on rebranding assisted suicide as assisted dying is to try and disconnect in people's minds. What this actually is about, you'd have to rewrite part of the 1961 Suicide Act to create an exception. So that would make, so it would be illegal for you or I to help someone to kill themselves, but it would no longer be illegal for a doctor within these certain conditions.
Yes, that's right. And it's also worth noticing that if you look around the world at similar legislation, how different language is used in the Netherlands, the Dutch, with their reputation for being pretty blunt and straight, just talk about euthanasia and assisted suicide. in Canada, there's this rather strange phrase, medical aid in dying. And in Oregon, the act which supports assisted suicide is called the Dignity in Dying Act. So it's fascinating to see the way that different countries choose different wording to describe what's fundamentally the same act.
Some people think that we should kind of get stuck into a culture war on the language and refuse to give an inch and continue to stubbornly call it assisted suicide, even though the proponents and the literal name of the bill is the Assisted Dying Bill. What's your view on that?
Well, I think it is a bit, it's quite a difficult and nuanced position. I certainly want to point out the importance of language, because this has always been bedeviled, the debates about various forms of mercy killing, and the very selection of the word euthanasia, which goes back several hundred years, literally meaning good death, that was selected to refer to medical killing for euphemistic reasons. So I think it's important to talk about the language and to flag up that this is a manipulative use of language. But nonetheless, I think it's better, given that assisted dying is now the currency that is being used, and that the Assisted Dying Bill 2021 is being debated in the Houses of Parliament. I think it probably makes sense for us to refer to as assisted dying with perhaps this little proviso that we just point out the strangeness of the name.
Hmm. So let's get into it then. Some people will have heard of this, some people might not. What is the Assisted Dying Bill 2021? Who proposed it? What is it trying to do?
Yeah, so Baroness Meacher has proposed this as a private bill. It isn't sponsored by any of the political parties, but it is currently going through the House of Lords. It's had the first reading earlier this year, and there's going to be a very important debate taking place on the floor of the House of Lords on the 22nd of October. And the bill is basically, the provision of the bill is that in order to qualify for assisted suicide, or assisted dying, you should be, first of all, an adult with a terminal illness. So, and a terminal illness is defined as less than 6 months to live. Interestingly, you don't have to have any degree of suffering or pain or distress or deterioration of function or disability. You simply have to have a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live. Secondly, you have to show that you are mentally competent, and that you are, and thirdly, that you're not subject to coercion by any other person, that this is a pure autonomous decision of yourself to kill yourself. And if you meet those criteria, two independent doctors are supposed to assess and certify that that's the case. If they suspect there's any kind of mental illness such as depression, they are instructed that they have to seek the advice of a psychiatrist. They then has to be confirmed by the High Court. There has to be a 14-day waiting period, unless it's a very urgent situation. And then the doctor prescribes a lethal oral medication, a selection of drugs which are designed to kill rapidly and cleanly and painlessly. He or she gives the medication, instructs the person how to take it, but in the end, the person themselves, who wants to kill themselves, they have to take the medication themselves, and the doctor is supposed to stay there with the patient until death has occurred.
While it's obviously a new bill in 2021, it's actually very closely modelled on previous legislation that's been introduced to the House of Lords and the House of Commons in the past, isn't it?
It is. It's almost entirely a rerun of bills that were debated in both the Lords and the Commons back in 2015. And at that time, they were very, particularly in the Commons, there was a very strong, large majority against. There was a very good, high quality debate within the on the floor of the House. And in the end, the MPs voted strongly 2-1 against changing the law. But we're in a different world now. Things have moved. And interestingly, the House of Lords in some ways has changed its complexion.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, and I'd be interested in your perspective on all this. But my perspective is that whereas historically the House of Lords was always seen as tending towards traditional attitudes, conservative with a small c, and opposing very radical changes, the atmosphere in the House of Lords is very different now. And I think there are a number of reasons why that is. Partly it's because many of the hereditary peers no longer have the right to participate in debates. There's been an appointment of a lot of younger peers by both political parties, but particularly by the Labour Party, by Tony Blair's government and succeeding governments have packed the benches with their own party apparatchiks, maybe that's a bit unfair, but by people who are their own supporters. And and generally speaking, the atmosphere within that, there is a strong radical and liberal with a small l faction within the House of Lords.
Yeah, I find this particularly fascinating as a previous student of British history. And I remember studying at school, at university, various kind of major political reforms throughout the kind of Victorian and 20th century eras. And almost always the House of Lords was a kind of reactionary block to what was perceived as progress, with things like, you know, expanding the franchise to women or to working class men or various other reforms like that. It was the MPs who were forward thinking and trying to push society forward. And the Lords was a historically, I guess you say, a traditionalist, small c conservative, reactionary block, which stood there and said, you know, we won't stand for this. And it is fascinating to see how in some senses, you could even argue that that has shifted. And now the Lords seems to me to be, there's a significant number of people who are kind of taking up their seat in the Lords quite explicitly because they kind of see it as a cockpit for their kind of freelancing, legislating, creative, imagineering, reforming. Lots of those people, like you mentioned, people who've been appointed by both Labour and Conservatives since the reforms in the 1990s got rid of most of the hereditary peers. And there's a real sense in which, you know, they are kind of, it's a job for life. It's not you don't have to get re-elected. You're not accountable to anyone. They're often people who might have kind of retired from a previous career and have lots of time on their hands. And they are fundamentally, unlike MPs, they don't have a constituency. They don't have an electorate that they have to go and engage with, let alone be re-elected by every 5 years. And that gives them a freedom to kind of explore interesting, radical, progressive ideals.
Yeah, it is really interesting, isn't it? And I wonder also whether, you know, many of them, as you've said, they're recently retired professional people or professional politicians or whatever. So they're very much a boomer generation. They've had, you know, the concerns of the baby boomers. They've experienced relative wealth. They're used to independence, to individual autonomy, to be able to you know, further their own individual ends. And it's interesting that death and dying is seen as one of the last bastions against this kind of radical liberal revolution, which you can trace back to the 1960s. And I know that some people from the kind of libertarian and liberal perspectives think it's just completely outrageous that here in 2021 you cannot decide. Although you can control every other aspect of your life, it's outrageous that you cannot control the time and the manner of the way you die. Of something so important, surely we must have the right to choose.
Hmm. And I also think it's a really interesting to note how While, you know, a lot of MPs also come from a kind of upper middle class, white collar, professional background, by virtue of being a public representative, they all, every Friday, they all depart Westminster and head back into their constituencies across the UK, and they spend a day doing effectively kind of like quasi social work, where constituents come to them and say, you know, I've got this problem with my benefits, or I'm in this dispute with the council, and they mediate and they advocate and they lobby, and they receive countless emails and letters from real ordinary human beings. And I think for all the flaws of our parliamentary system, this is a great aspect because it ties these MPs to the real world. They're actually better informed than almost anyone else in kind of Westminster, London kind of elite society, because every week they're dragged back into the real world and the kind of suburban, ordinary concerns of middle England. Whereas peers just can live in this rarefied Westminster bubble, and, you know, in the kind of salons and clubs and bars, get carried away with their kind of reforming radical liberal ideals.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. One of the interesting things that, that came out of the previous debate in the House of Commons on this topic was that it was clear that many MPs, you know, who hadn't thought a great deal about death and dying prior to the debate, because they took it very seriously, they knew this was an important debate, they wanted to do the right thing, so they went into their constituents and found out whether anybody with their hospices that looked after dying people here, and so they'd gone and looked and spoken to their local hospital. Many MPs said, you know, we're in our constituent, we're very proud of the work of our local hospice, and I went along and I talked to them, and to my surprise, the people working in the hospice who were experts in dying were not in favour of this bill, and they gave me a number of reasons why not, so I felt I need to say that to the House. And you know, again, as you say, it was a very impressive seeing how seriously the MPs took this work. I think the whole point about it is that once you take off the party allegiances and the party whips and you give MPs a conscience vote, then actually the quality of the democratic debate that can go on in both the Commons and the Lords is actually quite high.
It's worth pausing for a second, perhaps, for those who might not be familiar with kind of parliamentary procedure, explaining kind of the lie of the land ahead for the assisted dying bill. So the current stage it's at is it's been introduced and it's had a first reading, which is really just to kind of say there is this bill, it exists, but no vote is taken. And then it's been kind of, you know, circulated and digested by the peers. And what is happening next is what's called a second reading, which is in October, I think. And that's when there will be a debate about the bill on the floor of the House of Lords. People will say little speeches about what they think about it, and at the end they will take a vote. And if it is voted down, it dies there and then. But if it passes that stage, then it goes on to something called committee stage, which is where a small group of MPs will kind of pull out and explore it and rewrite bits of it, suggest amendments. And then it comes back for a third reading, which is the kind of final stage. And then, of course, if it passes all stages in the House of Lords, it then, before it becomes an actual law, it has to go to the House of Commons. And historically, social issues such as this, which don't have a kind of party political stance, the parties don't whip, which is to say they don't compel their MPs to vote the party line. There won't be an official Labour or Conservative or Lib Dem position on the bill, probably. MPs will be given a free vote, which means that they can vote however their conscience dictates. So it means that these kind of debates in Parliament are almost uniquely very difficult to predict, because the parties don't have set standing. So you can't just count up numbers and see who's going to win.
That's right. And interestingly, a YouGov poll quite recently in August surveyed MPs on this particular question on the assisted dying bill and said, were they in favour or against? And the results were very interesting, because very approximately 35% said, yes, we're in favour, 35% said, no, we're against, and the remaining said, we're undecided at the moment. So you get the strong impression that it's actually very finely balanced, and that it could go either way. I mean, if all those who are undecided decide to vote in favour of the bill, it will pass with a very strong majority. But conversely, if they all decide to vote against, there will be a very strong majority against.
Shall we look a little bit briefly in a bit more detail at what the bill suggests and pull out what we might see as some of the flaws and the problematic elements of it?
Well, I think we're not going to have time to do a sort of detailed dissection. Just to say that I've written a document called What's Wrong with the Assisted Dying Bill, which is available on my website and also has been published by CARE, I think, on their website. And I've been actively involved in writing a short book called Assisted Dying, which is going to be published jointly by CARE and by Christian Medical Fellowship. So I think in terms of sort of dissecting the arguments, I think we really haven't time to do this now. But just to point out that at first glance, it seems, you know, very plausible, very reasonable, very rational. There are appropriate safeguards, or so it seems. I think once you start digging in, my own belief, and along with many others, is in fact there are all kinds of holes and problems with it. And it's almost inevitable that even if it was passed, there would be immediately a whole series of test cases arguing, for instance, you know, why does it have to be 6 months? What if somebody has a degenerative condition like motor neurone disease and they are suffering, but they've got 9 months or 12 months? You know, how reliable is the 6 months? How good are doctors at spotting whether there's any kind of coercion or manipulation from relatives, or and so on? So I think there are all kinds of issues. And one of the questions is, you know, as we look elsewhere in the world, what can we learn from how this kind of legislation has gone on?
And there's one of the most interesting things that has changed since Britain last debated this, which was the Rob Maris bill in the House of Commons in 2015, is that in that time, Canada has become one of the latest countries to legalize its own kind of regime of assisted suicide, which it calls medical assistance in dying. And that's actually something I've been looking into quite recently. I've been doing some research, some work for a charity called the Religion Media Center, and did a briefing about assisted dying. And so I did some reading around the world and spent some time kind of finding out what's really been happening in Canada, how the law was passed in the first place, but also what's happened in the kind of 5 or 6 years since they brought in their own assisted dying regime.
Yeah, and again, we probably haven't got time to go into detail, and the more detailed information will be written up elsewhere. But what were the things that really struck you from as you investigated what had been going on in Canada?
I think the most striking thing that jumped out as I was doing some reading and speaking to a few Canadian doctors on the phone was just the speed and the almost the severity of the slippery slope. The slippery slope is a kind of argument that people might be familiar with, which says, you know, when you legalize even a very restricted, limited form of assisted dying, it will quickly kind of expand until you end up with something which was not what anyone was calling for in the first place. And it's often derided by proponents of assisted dying as a kind of canard, a philosophical fallacy. It's seen as like you can just dismiss it. And what is absolutely striking is that Canada is a real-time, real-life example of how the slippery slope works, because it's just been five years since the first person was killed or died under Canada's MAID, MAID laws, medical assistance in dying. And yet, in that very short time, the kind of euthanasia procedures have expanded and spread and evolved in incredible speed.
So in what way is that? Because originally it was intended for people who effectively suffering terribly and who were close to death, wasn't that was what the Supreme Court said, wasn't it? There were particular cases that it was based on, but the Canadian Supreme Court then said that it was the duty of the different states in Canada to come up with procedures to help people who were in extreme difficulty and suffering at the end of life.
That's exactly right. So it was a Supreme Court case which ruled that the kind of absolute prohibition that existed in Canadian law on assisting suicide was unconstitutional. And so that forced the government to create an assisted dying law. But the law was quite strictly limited. It said You had to be 18 or older, mentally competent, suffering from a very serious physical health condition, in an advanced state of decline, in severe suffering, which was unsolvable, and someone whose natural death was, quote, reasonably foreseeable. And this was normally interpreted as, again, similar to the UK legislation, around 6 months. And what has happened since is that within almost overnight, as soon as the law came in, the advocates and euthanasia kind of lawyers and pro-euthanasia doctors began nibbling away at the edges and pushing. And so it's the 6 month limit, through a combination of kind of court cases and precedent and public campaigning, has slipped now first to 5 years, then it became 10 years. And now I think it's basically you don't have to be terminally ill at all. And also what you've seen is the eligibility criteria have been expanded as well. So initially it deliberately excluded anyone under 18 who wasn't terminally ill and who had a psychiatric condition. And you had to be able to give kind of informed consent on the day of your death, which excluded people with things like dementia as well. And what's happened in Canada is that has gradually been unpicked. Through again a combination of legal challenges, but also ultimately the government passed a kind of reform to the bill, its own bill, earlier this year. So less than 5 years after the bill was passed in the first place, the government was rewriting it. And that struck out the requirement to be terminally ill, but also set in motion to expand it in 2 years' time. It will expand to include psychiatric conditions, so you don't have to have cancer or a severe degenerative condition. You could simply just be suffering from depression or anxiety, and if you say that your suffering is unbearable, even if you're 21 years old and could reasonably expect to live for another 70 years. If two doctors agree that your suffering is unbearable and you have a clear and voluntary settled wish to die, 14 days later, you can be given a lethal injection.
And what about younger people as well? There's been movements of that, hasn't there? Again, people less than 18 years old?
That's right. So at present, the law is still the case that you have to be over 18, but there is, in the reform bill that they passed earlier this year, they included a commission to explore the question of whether so-called mature minors, so these are people who are legally minors because they're under the age of 18, but they're deemed to have enough mental capacity and competency to decide their own medical treatment. So this normally means kind of teenagers, basically, who are assessed as being, can understand what they're asking for. There's been, again, a huge amount of advocacy and lobbying, and that is now being formally considered by a parliamentary commission, I believe, whether they should expand it to under 18s.
And I understand paediatricians in Canada have been getting requests from parents, of children with severe problems and disabilities, for MAID. So it's definitely around. Conscience clauses and the protection from those who didn't, from doctors and hospitals who didn't want to have anything to do with it.
So similarly to what you hear in the UK, when this was going through the courts and through Parliament in Canada in 2015-16, everyone insisted that there would be very rigorous conscience provisions. And so if you were a doctor or a nurse, or even, the manager of a hospital, and you decided you didn't agree with medical assistance in dying, you could opt out, and no one would be able to kind of compel you to take part. But what has actually happened in practice is much more complex, and so there are quite a number of Christian institutions as part of Canada's kind of public health system, like hospitals and surgeries and charities who are funded by the kind of state, but have a kind of Christian ethos, and sometimes even run still by kind of nuns and that kind of thing. And many of those have it kind of written into their constitutions that they're barred from taking part in things in euthanasia of any sort. And what has happened in many cases is that there has been vigorous campaigning by local pro-euthanasia advocates saying that this amounts to a postcode lottery. So, for example, if the argument goes, you know, assisted dying is a legal right of every citizen in Canada, and if your local hospital is a Catholic hospital and has decided to opt out, that means that people in that vicinity are being denied their legal right, QED, the hospital should not be allowed to conscientiously object. And so we've seen a number of often Catholic origin or Christian origin institutions who have been either bullied and threatened or actively sued to and have now caved and have agreed to allow assessments and sometimes even actual euthanasia administration to take place on their properties. But also I've been speaking to some Canadian doctors, many of whom have deep misgivings about this and have a very clear sense in which, you know, their job is to heal and is to protect life, and they did not sign up when they trained as doctors to take life. Because it's worth noting that in Canada, it's not just assisted suicide, but there's also euthanasia. So the 99% of people who die are not killing themselves, but are being given a lethal injection by their doctor. And so there are doctors across Canada who have stated again that they have a conscientious objection and they won't take part. And some provinces have accepted that, but in other provinces, including Ontario, which is Canada's largest province and includes, you know, cities like Toronto, the local health authorities there have been very critical and hostile of doctors, Christian or otherwise, trying to conscientiously object. I spoke to one doctor who said they've been told, okay, they don't have to physically inject a patient themselves, but if a patient requests euthanasia, they are obliged to refer them to a doctor colleague they know who will provide euthanasia. And this doctor said, well, that also breaches my conscience. I can't be involved at any stage in the chain, even if I'm not the person actually depressing the syringe. And their health authority said, tough, those are the rules. And so this doctor is currently in a battle and is opening themselves up to disciplinary action and maybe even suspension.
Yeah, so it is quite startling, isn't it? I too, you know, reading up about Canada, have been really startled at the speed. And I do find it very disturbing because, you know, although very often the euthanasia activists, those in favour of a change of the law, they point to other places like the Netherlands or like the state of Oregon. I think the closest analogy we have is Canada. You know, what do you think about that? I mean, why do you agree with that? Or do you think that, you know, these examples from these other countries are also relevant?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, I think it is worth looking into what happens in Oregon, particularly as Oregon's regime is probably most similar to what the Baroness Meacher bill is trying to introduce. So in Oregon, it's not a euthanasia regime. It's just assisted suicide. The patient is always the person who takes the final act to kill themselves. But again, I think there are huge problems with the comparison because Oregon is such a different healthcare system to the UK. It's obviously a private system, insurance-based system. And so the doctors who are taking part are, you know, private doctors who are being paid by private healthcare insurance companies if it's offered. And so it's much more individualistic. It's almost like an opt-in system. And the fascinating thing about Canada is that while they don't exactly have an NHS like us, they do have universal state-funded healthcare, which actually works through kind of government, as far as I understand it, government kind of run insurance. And so that's why we've seen the kind of the spectre of the postcode lottery. And because the whole point is that the Supreme Court effectively said that Canadians have a constitutional right to be killed by their doctors should they so request in these circumstances. That means that in every province, in every town, in every county of Canada, this has to be made available. And that is much more akin, I think, to what situation that we would have here, which is that it would become integrated into the NHS, you know, a secular state-funded health system. And it would be rolled out automatically across every NHS hospital. And so I think Canada is a really, really instructive example that, and when you read the arguments from the kind of pro Dying with Dignity Canada, I think they're called, the kind of pro lobby, they're so reminiscent of what you hear in the UK. So they're very calm, they're very soothing. Don't worry, this is very going to be very strict. It's just going to be 6 months live, a tiny number of people. The numbers will be small. It's worth noting that the numbers have gone up every single year. I believe they've now increased 300% people each year who are wanting, who are taking on, who are requesting assisted suicide. And they also say that, don't worry, this won't affect palliative care. This will be a really small, minor, progressive reform for a few people. There'll be plenty of conscience provisions. And that's all the same kind of reassuring words that you hear from Dying with Dignity UK in this country, formerly known as the Voluntary Euthanasia Society, it's worth noting. But the truth is that actually as soon as they kind of got a foothold in the law, things began to unravel much, much faster than almost anyone expected.
Yeah, so we probably ought to be bringing things to a close, but I think it's there are lots of reasons to be concerned. And I think this next, the debate that's going to come up in the House of Lords, and almost certainly there will also be debates in the House of Commons in the next few months, are going to be very critical for the future of medicine in this country. And I think it's just perhaps on this final point that the point about the care of the dying and whether or not some kind of suicide or intentional killing is allowed as part of medical care, that affects pretty much every clinical department throughout the NHS, because virtually all areas of a modern hospital deal with dying people. And therefore, once the law on dying is changed, once some kind of form of medical intervention to bring about death is legalised, this will have enormous repercussions across the whole of the NHS. And so I think in a future podcast, we'll think more about that and possibly look at sort of disaster scenarios, what might happen if the law was changed. Is there a way of creating euthanasia-free zones within the NHS or within some kind of private healthcare system?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot more to dig into in this. It's also worth kind of noting, isn't it, that on your website, John, you've got a large amount of resources, not just this piece you mentioned about what's wrong with the assisted dying bill, but for people who aren't maybe familiar with the debate, about the kind of debate in general, there's some interesting work I've read about. You've got pieces about the argument from autonomy and the argument from compassion, and some of your books as well go into this in detail. So if people who maybe want a bit of a refresher or a backgrounder, there's loads of good material there on johnwyatt.com.
Great. Well, I'm sorry it's been a grisly topic this morning, but I think it's an important one. And I'm very close to home. So I look forward to having further discussions in the future.
Great. I'll speak to you soon. Thank you. That's it for this episode of Matters of Life and Death. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do share it with friends or on social media. It can be found on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or all other major podcast apps. As always, don't forget to check out John's website, which has plenty more resources to read, listen to, and watch on lots of the things that we've talked about in the podcast and much more besides. You can find it at johnwyatt.com. That's johnwyatt.com. And if for some reason you'd even like to follow me online, I'm at T.S. Wyatt on Twitter, and you can find some of my journalism at tswyatt.com. You can get in touch with us by emailing mattersoflifeanddeathpodcast@gmail.com, or just send me a tweet. We're always keen to hear from listeners, especially if you have a question to ask, a topic you'd like us to explore, or a news development to respond to. The music in the show is, as always, by Daniel Birch. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you again next time.